Dr. Mihai Nadine joined the UTD faculty last year to head up the new institute, one devoted to research in anticipatory systems. It has to do with embedding the very human characteristic of anticipating into software for computers and other devices. One challenge is obvious. Computers have been, in essence, told how to think. Now we may be asking them to think like the machines we call humans. How it's possible to do it, how the technology might be developed, and for that matter, who thought of the whole thing in the first place, is something that was the subject of a series of lectures Dr. Nadine gave last month. Dr. Nadine is a native of Romania. He's been called a 21st century Renaissance man. He's taught at Berkeley, Stanford, the Rhode Island School of Design, Ohio State, and in Germany. He was one of the first researchers to address the possible connection between the computer and human creativity. We have him for the first half hour today, and if you have a question for him, we're at 800-933-5372. We're also at gms@kera.org. Welcome.
Thank you.
If they're called anticipatory systems, who or what does the anticipating?
That is the question that I hear the most often in my life. Anticipation is an autonomous function. In other words, it is triggered from inside the living. There is no agent for the anticipation. Every part of the living participates in the act of anticipation.
Mm-hmm. And by the living, you mean, this is a phrase that turns up in some of your interviews and so forth, the living beings, living entities, living the systems?
The distinction between what we call the physical reality, the stones and the minerals and you name all the other entities, and the living is a very tricky distinction, and sometimes science ran away from it. Mm-hmm. And we were even told, you know, don't put your fingers on this distinction, because pretty soon you will have to answer some other questions. So some 400 years ago, we were told, leave away everything that has to do with vitalism, which was the term used in mm-hmm. those days. Keep your fingers away from anything that might suggest that this category that we have, the living, has something of a mystical entity that distinguishes it from mm-hmm. The physical. However, whether we want or not to avoid the subject, because it has so many traps, we know that stones do not feel pain, and we feel pain. Mm-hmm. So there is a distinction there. And there are so many others. So to your question, how far would we go with the definition of the living? We go as far as to start with the monocell mm-hmm. and end up with what we know as of today as being the most complex living, which is the human mm-hmm. being.
How do these three things either compare or are they different? Anticipating, reacting, and predicting.
The first two, anticipating and reacting, define, if you want, in some ways our subject today. Mm-hmm. In the physical world, we have reaction. Newton told us that every action is a reaction. And we build on this knowledge, and all the machinery that we have around is based on this knowledge. In the living, we have, together with reaction, because the living has also a physical reality, another characteristic, which is the characteristic of anticipation. Now you introduce the third term, which is the term prediction. Prediction has to do with how is the knowledge that we have, knowledge about the physical world or the living, used in order to deal with that dimension of existence, which is called the future. Mm-hmm. Predictions related to the physical world correspond to the observations that we made over a very long period of time and which are then translated into physical laws. So if you look at the physical law of gravity, there is no big prediction to say that the stone will fall down.
Right.
But there are other predictions that start being a little more complicated, such as those, can you predict the weather? Mm-hmm. And here we are in a more tricky territory where the relation between what we observed and what might take place in the future is no longer so evident.
If you want to talk with us, we're at 800-933-5372. We're also at gms@kera.org. Dr. Mihai Nadine is director of the Institute for Research in Anticipatory Systems at the University of Texas at Dallas. I started by asking a more complicated question, anticipatory systems. What do you mean by anticipating? What's the function that's at work there?
Anticipating. Indeed, you formulated the question the right way, because it is an action. It should not even be used as a noun. It is an action.
Mm-hmm.
Anticipating means to be aware to integrate the experience, whether you are aware of it or not, into something that will guide the future.
Mm-hmm.
So to anticipate would mean in this case to have some notion of what might happen in the future.
So what are you trying to do? Create computer programs? Create new theories about the way that we anticipate? What are you up to? You have a whole institute at your beck and call. What is it that you're doing?
The honest answer is, if I would have it my way in life, and nobody has it totally the way we would like, I would totally dedicate myself to the theoretic foundation of anticipation, because the subject was simply avoided during the last 400 years of development of what we call science.
Mm-hmm.
Since we don't have it our way, I'm interested in at least translating that part of my theoretical research into practical applications. And obviously an institute at a university serving the public, being funded by the public and serving the public, has also the moral obligation to return value to mm-hmm. the public. Now, there are practical instances when the value of anticipation becomes critically important, such as anticipating extreme events. Now, extreme event sounds very abstract, but Katrina does not sound abstract.
Mm-hmm.
An earthquake doesn't sound abstract. Or if you want, the riots in France today, the event of the day, are no longer an abstract issue. So immediately one can notice that there is a practical implication to the research mm-hmm. as such.
Yeah. What happened 400 years ago that changed our thinking about this?
Good Descartes, and I hope that the listeners are familiar with the name Descartes. Good Descartes, like many other scientists during that time, noticed that if we look at reality, we have a problem in understanding reality and its complexity. Things are too much to understand at once. Since they are too much, what would be a possible path to deal with reality in practical terms so that, again, you would return some value mm-hmm. to society? And then he came up with at least three ideas which are very important and which marked the entire evolution of the Western world. And those ideas are the so-called reductionist thought. If you have in front of you something very complex, cut it into pieces, reduce it. That is what reductionist is.
Mm-hmm.
If you start understanding the smaller pieces, chances are, and he was very careful in his formulation, that you will understand the whole from which those pieces mm-hmm. eventually came. The second thought that he introduced, and some people might be surprised that only 400 years ago, was the relation between what he called a cause and effect. There is something followed by something else, and chances are that this sequence of action one followed by some result two are in some connection, and this is the so-called deterministic model mm-hmm. of the world. And the third, which very few people at that time paid attention to, it was the notion that we can reduce everything that there is to the functioning of a machine. Let's not forget the machines in his time were the pendulum,
mm-hmm.
one of the most complicated machines,
mm-hmm.
and hydraulic machines. In other words, things that were more or less activated or put in motion by water,
mm-hmm.
water falling. And this thought guided us, as I said already, over 400 years, and the results are spectacular. We look around, and I'm looking at everything surrounding us in the studio. Those are the results of these three premises that Descartes put.
Right.
But there's also something that got lost.
Mm-hmm.
And what got lost was the notion that the living is not exactly reducible,
mm-hmm.
either to the parts, or if it is reducible to a part, you don't understand how the whole functions. Second, that there is more than cause and effect in the sequence A, B, one before the other, and more than that, we're not reducible to machines. And this is a very important thought, which especially today becomes critical.
You've told an interviewer once, what makes my life difficult is the appearance that I'm arguing against things that seem to be working fine. Is that what you're talking about here?
Absolutely. And I don't take this difficulty as, you know, being my last chance to make a point. And mm-hmm. if I don't make it, we're going to be lost. We are educated. We were educated in the whole society over the last 400 years in the spirit of the thinking. Whenever I talk to friends or to other scholars or the Congress or with my students about anticipation, the first questions are questions of a deterministic nature, such as the question that you ask,
mm-hmm.
who is doing the anticipation? In other words, what's the cause mm-hmm. of anticipation? So if you reduce it back, then you say, are we again reducing the living to the non-living? That would be a big loss, because in the meanwhile, we made huge, but really huge progress in understanding the living. The entire development in the last 20, 30 years in biology, especially molecular biology, in understanding the DNA, in understanding genetics, those are openings into a territory in which everyone immediately noticed, wait a second, what we assumed until now is not exactly how things work.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are not, maybe we lost something. Maybe we should look for a source of knowledge that might be very significant today.
Yeah. We're at 800-933-5372. We're also at gms@kera.org. Let's try to take one call here before we have to take a break. Dr. Mihai Nadine, my guest, he's the director of the Institute for Research in Anticipatory Systems at the University of Texas at Dallas. We have until the half hour, so if you want to get a call in, don't wait. Austin, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Glenn, Dr. Nadine. Well, recently I saw an interview with a young postgraduate student inventor from MIT, and he had come up with a device that would record, you just walk around with it, and it would record 2 years of conversation, and then you could reference it back by saying, like, automobiles, and it would reference back every conversation you'd had on automobiles or existential philosophy or whatever subject. And it was like a memory. And, I mean, in a total philosophical sense. And, he said the biggest problem with getting it to, market was, the issue of privacy and, in that it could be subpoenaed, for instance, maybe, you know, in a court. I would like for you to, I love this conversation, but I would love for you to, talk about the philosophical, and moral implications of such a device.
Okay, and you have to do it in 30 seconds, because that's when we how much time we have during before the break.
30 seconds is always a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Such a device or any other device that more or less encounters rules that were formed in the past is not a surprise. We established a framework that at this moment starts constraining our formulating new questions. The device described by the listener is only one example. I can give at least another 10.
And we can do that when we come back. We'll be right back. Welcome back. For the next few minutes, we're talking with Dr. Mihai Nadine. He's the director of the Institute for Research in Anticipatory Systems at the University of Texas at Dallas. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll talk with Doug Beeson, author of The E-Bomb. And in the second hour, we'll talk with Kevin Finney, an Austin-based music writer whose new book is called Souled American. That's S-O-U-L-E-D, American, How Black Music Transformed White Culture. But we have a few more minutes for your phone calls and your questions for Dr. Nadine. Are you talking about teaching machines to think?
I don't think that we're talking about teaching the machine to think. I'm talking about conceiving machines that are able to learn, which are two different things. What does it mean to build a machine that is able to learn? Means that we have to endow it with some characteristics that mimic, and I repeat, mimic, what the living is doing. It's not an easy task. There is a little of a mathematical theory called the learning theory that is guiding us in such cases, but most of the learning happens in what we call intuitive learning. So we are trying to create so-called open systems that are able to pick up various information sources, put the information in some relation, and no longer process only one stream of information, but look rather at the various relations between these streams of information.
Okay. Let's get some more calls. And again, we're at 800-933-5372. We're also at GMS at KERA.org. Let's talk to David in Dallas. Hi.
Hi, Glenn. Hello, doctor. I had a question. It's been a while back. I minored in philosophy, and I stress the word minor. I took a seminar course from Dr. Pete Gunter at UNT, and it was called Process Philosophy. And a lot of it was based on a French biologist writing, Henri Bergson, and he stressed that the Newtonian physics, you know, is being cold balls of matter bumping around against each other, that actually even down to an atomic level, that they have a consciousness of each other. I just wanted to get your opinion, or if you were familiar with that philosophy, and I'll probably hang up and listen.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks.
I happen to be familiar, and I would like to draw your attention towards another scientist who probably wrote very close to the area that you just spelled out. His name is Walter Elsasser, and he tried to come with the scientific foundation of biology. Your question that you asked me would much be better answered by Elsasser, and it will take you a very, very short time to read. It's a relatively small book. It's Foundations of Biology. And you will also have a wonderful intellectual satisfaction in reading those pages. I'm not shying away from giving you a straight answer. Rather, I say, get the answer from the better source.
Email from Scott. This is such a big idea with a huge reach. What is the vision for anticipation at UTD? And how do you plan to bring this concept to the students? What does the coursework look like?
Excellent question, because in my mind there is no other justification for what we do as members of a university, as members of a university system, than to engage those we are working with, and in the first place are the students, obviously also our colleagues. Coursework. At this moment, I am teaching only one class in which anticipation is spelled out directly, and that class is called Games in Anticipation. I am teaching it together with a gamer in town, a professional who lives his, who earns his money, who makes a living by doing games, Richard Gray. Games in Anticipation, because each game between two livings involves anticipation. The games that we are getting now to know more and more, and which became a huge part of the economy, are deterministic machines in which the human being is somehow playing against something that was designed and it is presented to us by a machine. But there is much more to do. The second class that I am teaching has as the underlying foundation anticipation. It's called Story Lab. And some people will say, wait a second, what does it have to do with the scientific theory that tries to build new machines, etc., etc.? One of the most important assets that a company has today in the market is the story. And we don't understand yet what stories are. Stories are anticipatory mechanisms. Every story is actually written from the end to the beginning, as opposed to the deterministic from the beginning to the end. And we want in time to establish a very nice repository of stories from all over the world and start mining the stories in order to increase our knowledge. At the moment when we would be able to build one machine, a very simple machine, that can say the shortest possible story that would be also interesting, we know that we would really have achieved a milestone in anticipatory studies. Mm. That's just to answer some of these concrete questions.
Let's take one more question. We'll go to Meg in Fort Worth. Quick question. Hey, Meg.
Yes. Hi. I just have a quick question. My undergraduate degree was in music and technology. I just recently graduated. And I had a course called Music and Other Media, where we learned about a very broad spectrum, but one thing we studied was an artist who created a program about 20 years ago called Aaron. And this program started out where he taught it to draw, and it would, as the more it drew, it would grow in sophistication, and it began with typical kindergarten-looking pictures, and it has grown to where it incorporates color and now creates these very beautiful and sophisticated portraits. And it raised the question of whether or not this was actual art or not, because it was created by a computer. And I was just wondering how this correlates with talking about anticipatory and how human these kinds of computers are going to become.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful question, since Harold Cohen is a friend of mine, and I know quite a lot about Aaron. But I don't want to give you the story of my life, rather to answer your question. You ask a question that was asked many times. Is it art because it was generated with the help of a computer? The art was made by the artist. Whether the artist uses the medium called pencil, whether the artist uses whatever medium you want, as long as the artist is the one who conceives the art, is the one who can recognize when he is successful as opposed to other cases when he fails, it is art. I happen, for the reasons that I gave you, knowing the person, I happen to be probably subjective, but I'm very convinced about the quality of that art.
Dr. Nadine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Mihai Nadine is the director of the Institute for the Research in Anticipatory Systems at the University of Texas at Dallas. We'll take a very quick break and be right back. Welcome back. As Doug Beeson explains, the first directed energy, or DE, weapons, lasers, high-power microwaves, particle beams, have come of age. The first DE weapons are being developed. In the next few years, when they're unleashed on the battlefield, they'll be more revolutionary than the longbow, machine gun, stealth airplane, cruise missile, nuclear submarine, or atomic bomb. The second Iraq war may be the last, to depend on directed energy. What it is, how it's being developed, and how it might be used is the subject of a new book called The E-Bomb,
How America's New Directed Energy Weapons Will Change the Way Future Wars Will Be Fought. Dr. Doug Beeson is a leading expert in directed energy research with a PhD in laser technology physics. He was in both the Clinton and Bush administrations in the 90s and is now director of threat reduction at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. In addition to more than 100 scholarly articles and papers, he's the author of 12 previous books, including several novels. Again, the new book is called The E-Bomb, How America's New Directed Energy Weapons Will Change the Way Future Wars Will Be Fought. If you want to talk with him, we're at 800-933-5372. We're also at gms@kera.org. Doug, welcome.
Well, thanks. I appreciate the chance to be on the show.
Sure. If you could give us a sort of thumbnail definition of directed energy.
Well, sure. All directed energy is it's made up of the same stuff, if you will, that's emitted from the sun, from light bulbs, fluorescent lights, and that's just portions of electromagnetic frequency. The only difference is that these electromagnetic waves, instead of being randomly emitted and going in random directions, they all travel in the same direction. That's the first thing they have in common. And the second thing is that they're all what we call in phase, that is, they're all coherent, kind of like a large army with billions and billions of people that are marching all in lockstep. Directed energy is all around us. In fact, your DVD player, your CD player have solid-state lasers in them, your infrared remote, and there are two portions of electromagnetic frequency that are considered to be part of the directed energy spectrum, if you will, that is the microwaves. And then the lasers. The lasers typically from infrared, which is normally called the heat spectrum, all the way up to visible. And then microwaves, which is about a gigahertz all the way up to about 100 gigahertz.
And how are lasers different from high-power microwaves?
Well, there are just a couple differences. They're both portions, different portions of the electromagnetic spectrum. And so really the only difference is in wavelength. Microwaves have wavelengths about 10,000 times larger than lasers, and as a result, they diffract about 10,000 times more. So that means that you can only use microwaves, say, on the order of about a kilometer on a battlefield, and for lasers, since they're 10,000 times smaller, can go about 10,000 times farther. So that's why we can broadcast or we can shoot lasers, if you will, hundreds or even thousands of kilometers. Now, lasers are much more mature than microwaves. Right now, there have been several lasers that have actually been fielded in battle. For example, the Army's Zeus laser is one that was fielded in Afghanistan. It's a solid-state laser that sets back about 10 to 20 meters away from a target, and it can actually make landmines explode. There's a strategic laser system right now that's being developed for the Air Force called the Airborne Laser, which is designed to fit upon a 747, fly above 40,000 feet, and shoot down tactical ballistic missiles. But these are all very mature type systems where there's still a lot of research right now being done on microwaves, except for one type of microwave, which is really called a millimeter wave, non-lethal weapon, and that's called active denial. This has been demonstrated by the military. It was declassified about 4 years ago. And what it does is it produces what they call the active denial effect or the FLE effect. That is, when a person experiences these millimeter waves, it's like they're feeling the effects of a super hot oven being opened up in front of them, and all they want to do is turn and flee. This has been demonstrated at distances greater than 700 meters away. And the military is considering right now using this of what they call to assess somebody's intent. That is, right now, if you are defending a high-value target, such as an embassy or a schoolhouse, the only way that you have to do to protect these high-value targets is to either shout at somebody or to shoot them. You don't have any non-lethal way to protect or assess people's intent. What this active denial effect will do, it will enable commanders the ability to, in a non-lethal way, to test to see if people are really caught up in a mob mentality and rushing towards this embassy, or are they really intent upon taking it over.
If you have a question for Doug Beeson, we're at 800-933-5372. We're also at gms@kera.org. The new book is called The E-Bomb. So what are the problems of R&D on DE weapons, or if not problems, what are the challenges?
Well, some of the challenges right now, especially with microwaves, is shrinking the power supply enough so that it could be moved to the battlefield. Right now, it takes power supplies on the order of on the size of buildings in order to generate enough power so that these weapons can work in the laboratory. And they're really only being investigated in the laboratory right now. These are the microwave. And I don't see these weapons making it to the battlefield for at least a decade or so. On one hand, that's because the amount of funding that these weapons are this science and technology, microwave science and technology, has been getting is about 10 to 100 times less than what lasers have been getting. Another problem is that how will it be accepted by the military? That is, any type of new weapon system that you have that you're introducing to the battlefield that's going to replace another system, it has to be accepted by the military. For example, precision-guided weapons. When that was first introduced 20 years ago, there were a lot of people said, well, we don't have any need at all to make weapons very precise. That is, we have jet fighter pilots who can lay their weapons down as accurate as what we need. But it wasn't until we started adding GPS, for example, to bombs that the true utility of precision-guided weapons were really known.
Are we talking here about primarily offensive or defensive weapons?
Oh, defensive. And in fact, directed energy weapons are inherently defensive. They have a lot of very nice attributes that make them defensive weapons. For example, their speed of light. They, instead of taking minutes or seconds for a bullet or a bomb to reach a target, because directed energy weapons work at the speed of light, they deposit their energy instantly upon a target. Also, you can be nearly infinitely precise. That is because you're working with the electromagnetic spectrum. You can focus them down into these effects down to a very, very small spot. And what that does is, because you're focusing the energy on a small spot, anytime you try to defocus the energy and make it go over a larger spot, you're not getting the effect that you want. So it's inherently a defensive weapon and not an offensive mm-hmm. weapon.
Would this potentially be part of an ABM system, for example?
It could be. In fact, the Air Force is looking at using the airborne laser right now. This is a certain type of chemical laser that's being put on a 747 that they envision flying at 40,000 feet or greater. That is above what they call the cloud level. And what they want to do there is stand off many hundreds of kilometers away from where a theater ballistic missile is being launched. And while it's still in what they call the boost phase, that is while the rocket motor is still firing, this airborne laser will be able to direct its beam onto this this rapidly accelerating rocket and to be able to actually make it explode. And so this is one of what they call using a layered defense. Mm-hmm. That is, perhaps using a layer at the laser at the beginning of the boost phase, and then using other type of weaponry at other phases for an anti-ballistic missile defense system.
Doug Beeson is my guest. If you have a question for him, 800-933-5372. You can also email us at gms@kera.org. His new book is called The E-Bomb. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Doug Beeson's my guest. The new book is called The E-Bomb, How America's New Directed Energy Weapons Will Change the Way Future Wars Will Be Fought. Coming up in the next hour, we'll talk with Kevin Finney. He's the author of Souled American. That's S-O-U-L-E-D, American, How Black Music Transformed White Culture. If you have a question for us right now, 800-933-5372 or gms@kera.org. It's where we got this from, Ed. Would you please ask your guest to address the field of electromagnetic pulse weapons?
Well, that's a really good question. Electromagnetic pulse weapons is kind of what high-power microwave weapons would like to be based on. EMP actually was discovered back in the 50s during a nuclear test that occurred in the upper atmosphere, the low regions of space, called Starfish. And when that explosion happened, what had occurred was that electronics were burnt out for hundreds of miles around. And so it was felt that if somehow we could harness the devastating effects of this sudden electronic field, but yet not harm any people, then this would be a good way to take out all the electronics in the battlefield. The problem is using something like that in high-power microwaves, again, is that in theory it works great, in the laboratory it works great, but the power supply needed to produce something like that is just immense. Remember, this original effect was caused by an atomic bomb which powered this effect. Trying to do this conventionally, that is by using either capacitors or other types of storage devices, it's nearly impossible right now. And that's one of the big technological challenges of how do you transition what we can do in the laboratory at very small scales using PhDs. How can we transition that to the battlefield so that 19, 20-year-old soldiers can do it? And right now, the big problem is shrinking that power supply, which is really an immense technological challenge.
In what sense does the laser have a contentious past? Has there been debate over who created it or what, how to use it? Or
well, when lasers were invented back in 1960 by Theodore Maiman, who invented the ruby laser, it was on the order of a power of a level of about a milliwatt. That's what you get right now in your laser pointer. Since then, the power in lasers have increased by over a factor of a billion. That is where we are rapidly coming to the point where strategic weapons have power levels on the order of millions of watts versus milliwatts. Now, it was realized early on in the 1960s and 70s that this might be able to provide a really nice way of delivering energy if you could focus it. And so some of the first uses that people talked about were perhaps blinding people on the battlefield. Well, that was really considered inhumane, and just as we have chemical warfare type of treaties, we now have treaties and international protocols which prohibit the use of lasers being used on battlefields for blinding people, that is, dazzling them. But we can use lasers as a to deliver energy to non-human targets, say rockets, airplanes, tanks, and that type of thing.
Let's get some calls, 800-933-5372 or gms@kera.org. Dr. Doug Beeson, my guest. We'll start with Mike in Dallas. Hi.
Yeah, a couple of quick questions. How does this tie in with the ABM, the failed missile tests recently, and also are the Chinese or other potentially threatening powers working on things like this? Or also, will these ever be condensed into shoulder helmets like Allah? Leslie Nielsen on Forbidden Planet, something like that.
Okay, well, the first thing, as I mentioned earlier, lasers are being considered for use right now in the first part of a layered anti-ballistic missile system, where it's just a very small part at the very beginning. And so, and it should be realized is that lasers or any type of directed energy weapons are not going to be a panacea. That is, they're always going to be part of the bigger solution and not the entire solution themselves. The second is that these weapons, other countries are looking at using them, but because the technical challenges are so formidable, especially in the large strategic systems such as the airborne laser, this system has been under investigation for over 10 years. It's an incredibly difficult science and technology challenge to not only get a laser that powerful, but to make it stable, to have the beam control, to have the acquisition targeting, pointing and tracking, and to be able to target and be able to propagate it through the atmosphere, that really only a superpower will be able to pull this off, even if we're lucky enough to pull it off.
If it is perfected, could it make ballistic nuclear weapons obsolete, say, several decades out?
That's always the dream, and again, it's going to be part of the system. I don't see a proliferation of this type of system for many decades because of the technological complexity of it. And as far as shrinking this right now, boy, that is a really tough problem. It's nice to see these science fiction films where you have shoulder-held lasers and stuff, but there are practical energy considerations of how do you get all that energy that's stored in, say, even a 747 shrunk down to a shoulder-harnessed weapon. I don't really see that happening, at least for these strategic type of systems.
To Daryl in Dallas. Good afternoon.
Yes, I was wanting to ask Dr. Beeson if there's been any research, in the basic physics level of neutralizing mechanical, biological, any kind of aggressive systems. Something similar on the order of, in the day the Earth stood still, the problem that was posed to the alien where he neutralized all mechanical systems around the world or whatever it was. If there's anything like that, it seems like that would be the most appropriate to try to guide toward.
Well, Well, there are two types of effects here. One is going against the electronics of a system. In fact, the dream of the people who are investigating and researching high-power microwaves right now, which is still at the laboratory, is that the smarter that you can make a weapon, the dumber that we can make it. That is, the more electronics that it has on board, the more susceptible it is and more vulnerable it is, and the better that high-power microwaves can go after it. So that's kind of always been the dream. Not exactly a mechanical, but mostly electronic defense. But again, we have all these problems with shrinking the power supply and how do you get it out to the field. The second part of the question with going against the biology, that kind of goes hand in hand with this active denial effect, which occurs with millimeter waves. This is an effect that's been studied by the military for over a decade. And what occurs around a frequency of about 100 gigahertz is that these millimeter waves are absorbed in about the first third millimeter of the skin. Now, this is unlike other types of radiation or electromagnetic spectrum, which actually can go through your body. Radio waves, for example, travel through your body. For millimeter waves, because they're absorbed about the first third of a millimeter of your skin, your nerves actually perceive this as heat. It's not heat. It's not infrared radiation, but it's perceived like that. Now, this is non-ionizing, and it really does not do any damage to the skin. But because the nerves perceive it as heat, the body itself feels like a huge conventional oven has been opened up in front of it. And what people want to do is turn and flee. This is called the flee effect. And what the military is doing presently is looking at perhaps using a phenomena such as the flee effect as a use of non-lethally being able to keep people away from certain high-value targets, such as airfields. And so, in a way, I guess it's not really what you point out, the science fiction Earth Stood Still phenomena of stopping biological entities. But on the other hand, it is a way to perhaps for the military to use a non-lethal defense against oncoming crowds.
Dr. Doug Beeson's my guest. He's a retired Air Force colonel. He is currently the director of threat reduction at the Los Alamos National Laboratory and serves on the board of directors of the Directed Energy Professional Society. If you have a question for him, 800-933-5372, or also at gms@kera.org. The new book is called The E-Bomb. Let's get a call from Mason in Fort Worth. Hi.
Hi. I don't know much about lasers or anything, just so this might be a basic question. But could missiles or something like that be made out of a reflective material so the laser just bounces off of it?
Yeah, in fact, that's a great question. It's one of the ones that the first criticisms of using lasers for missile defense was what would happen if people just coated their rockets with a reflecting material. Well, as it turns out, that question was brought to task in a lot of experiments, and what was discovered is that unless the mirror surface is perfectly reflecting, that is, it's on about the same quality of a very high quality astronomical telescope, then you're always going to have some absorption of that laser radiation. And in fact, if you look even at high quality mirrors, the military is having a hard problem not having its mirrors destroyed by these high power systems. These mirrors, when I say high quality, they don't vary more than one-tenth of a wavelength, where a wavelength is 1,000 billionths of a meter long. And so to be able to coat a rocket with that type of precision is practically impossible. In fact, like I said, they've shown in tests in White Sands, New Mexico, that it's not possible to do that. But that is a great question.
Let's get a call next from Marcia in Keller. Hi.
Hi. Listen, Glenn, I'm not really sure if this question needs to go to this guest or just your previous. My question is this. How near or far are we from having a device that can identify on a cellular, a molecular level, that would either, let's say, it could be used beneficially to eradicate a cancer cell worldwide or smallpox worldwide, but then on the other hand, it could eradicate an entire ethnic group, or you see where I'm going? It sounds pretty scary to me.
Well, that's I'm really not an expert in those matters, and I Laser surgery is about the closest that I could get to, eradicating tumors and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, what you're talking about is just really out of the realm of my expertise. By the way, I'm, not representing Los Alamos in any way here, not talking about policy, mostly just trying to answer technical questions.
Sure. Well, here's a technical question. How would the use of these weapons affect the idea of manpower density on the battlefield? Would you need fewer soldiers?
Oh, absolutely in this. In fact, it's shown that science and technology throughout the years has decreased the number of men and women that are needed on the battlefield to conduct war, because you are extending the lethal range of these weapons. For example, the range of the arrow is extended by the bullet, by the rifle, by rockets, and so on. And so because of the inherently defensive nature of directed energy, that is, travels at the speed of light, infinitely precise, and it also offers something else that most other weapons don't provide, that is the ability to give you a graduated type of effect. That is, for a bullet, you either hit somebody or you don't hit somebody. And so you either have a lethal effect or a non-lethal effect. For these directed energy weapons, you can have what they call a dial-in effect. That is, at very, very low powers, you can disrupt systems, you increase the power more, you might be able to deny people access to these systems, and then at ultra-high powers, you might even be able to destroy those systems. So it provides you with a very humane way, in a very precise way, in a very instantaneous way of going against somebody else's weapons.
Let's get a call next from Rick in Arlington. Hi.
Hi. I had a relative who's since passed away who worked on manned portable laser systems during the Vietnam War at Los Alamos. And he said that the systems he worked on used small explosive charges, essentially blanks, to generate an electromagnetic pulse that provided the energy to fire the weapon. Is that sort of along the lines of what these weapons are like now?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat the part about the blank again? I missed that.
He worked on a laser rifle that used used blanks, like an ammo without a bullet, and the explosion generated an electromagnetic pulse that fired the weapon. That's where the energy came from.
Well, gee, I'm not really too familiar with that. That might have occurred, but what you're doing there is you're converting one form of energy to another, that is the explosive power into electromagnetic power. That's what it sounds like. And anytime you have any type of energy conversion where it's not a direct, say, electrical to light or directed energy power conversion,
mm-hmm.
it's very inefficient because some of that energy is carried away by kinetic energy, some by sound, some by the blast pressure waves.
Yeah.
So that might have been used in the past, but today it's what they call direct conversion, and that's why future laser systems, such as electric lasers, free electron lasers, for example, what we're investigating now at Los Alamos, that is converting electron beams straight into laser light by accelerating those electron beams across a magnet, making them wiggle. And when they wiggle, they actually produce laser radiation. That's called a free electron laser. Is an extremely efficient way of producing this energy. So that might have happened in the past. I'm not really sure about that, but it's not really the path that people are taking nowadays.
Well, Doug, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the chance.
Doug Beeson's book is called The E-Bomb, How America's New Directed Energy Weapons Will Change the Way Future Wars Will Be Fought. We'll be right back.